Hello and welcome to Monocle 24's The Urbanist, the show all about the cities we live in. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on today's programme, we're going all the way up to the Nordics.
For decades, Icelanders traded their hardy sheep with the British for the material. The capital city even enforced a building code, requiring that new builds were sided in the stripy iron.
The Nordic region has long fostered a distinct set of values that have helped its nations excel in quiet diplomacy and thoughtful design. It's no coincidence that over the years, every time we looked for examples of best-in-class urbanism, we found ourselves turning to cities of the likes of Stockholm, Copenhagen, and Helsinki. So join us as we explore a few exciting projects from cities across the Nordic region to celebrate the release of our new title, The Monocle Book of the Nordics. That's all coming up over the next 30 minutes, right here on The Urbanist, with me, Andrew Tuck. The Nordic nations are home to many of the world's leading design and urban planning studios, and are also the birthplace of an array of visionary architects who've changed our cities. It's a region that we've regularly turned to over the years, and the culmination of all of those stories and exciting urban infrastructure, policies and architecture can now be found in our new book, The Monocle Book of the Nordics. So let's start today's programme in Helsinki, because Finland has just published new architectural guidelines that spell out its vision of what the future of architecture should look like. And it's safe to say that we were intrigued. Our correspondent, Petri Butzoff, went out to investigate and brought us this report.
In its recently published architectural policy program, Finland sets out guidelines and recommendations that should guide architecture and architects for years to come. This national program follows in the footsteps of Finland's first architecture policy launched almost 25 years ago, and one that received widespread international recognition as one of the first national-level ambitious architecture policies. But what exactly does a government architecture policy mean? Despite sounding somewhat bureaucratic and centralized, the purpose is not for the government to decide what kind of buildings will be built, as Eva Astala from the Finnish Architecture Information Center, ArcInfo, explains.
This program is made very much to inspire municipalities, regions, cities to make their own architectural policy programs, and not just to make the policy programs, but also to spur discussion, involve citizens, talk about architecture and high quality built environment and make better livable places.
The program sets out five key areas that should guide the way Finland's future built environment is developed.
The built environment plays a key role in solving climate change issues. Then secondly, in the future, architecture creates the conditions for a good life and equal opportunity for everybody. Thirdly, it is stated that high quality architecture and built environment strengthens visibility throughout Finland, so both in urban and rural. And fourthly, it states that everyone has an opportunity to discuss and learn more about the built environment and participate in its development even stronger in the future. And finally, architectural education and research in Finland are of even higher quality than today.
In Finland, there is a vibrant public debate about the role of architecture in shaping the built environment and the society. Architecture education is part of the national curriculum from an early age, and most people live and spend their days in buildings that were designed and built in their lifetime.
So actually only 5% of the Finnish building stock is more than 100 years old, so it's really young. I think we have the youngest building stock in all of Europe, so our building heritage is that of a modern architecture. We have a lot of buildings that reflect the social sort of structures and our society. So there's a lot of buildings of high quality that are not only churches and town halls, but hospitals, schools, public buildings in general. And a lot of these are, as you mentioned, formed through competitions. And these open competitions also make it possible for young architects and new firms to emerge and find jobs and create new architecture.
Architects have been closely involved in the planning of the new architecture policy, and the reception has been good, as architect Mika Savela from the Finnish Arts Promotion Center explains.
I think in general, architects understand obviously why this policy exists. It has a sort of a tradition here, and it just tries to direct or give this sort of a vision that in each category, what is the sort of the big level goal. I think in general, we are facing this question that in our transition towards like sustainability and circular economies and all that, maybe the aesthetics of the environment, the design decisions, the technical solutions that we use or go towards will somehow change architecture. But I don't think that's the main goal here. It is left up to architects, obviously, and urban planners and designers to decide what the built environment will look like.
The role of the architect has changed, at least in Finland, from the individual to the collective. The days when star architects such as Alvar Aalto and Elia Saarinen were seen as national icons and builders of the young nation have given way to architects that work together with the civil society, public bodies, and businesses to collectively shape the built environment that we all share. This requires cooperation across the boundaries, as well as a strong civic education about architecture, Finland's policy program argues.
That's kind of like the Achilles heel of modern architecture, that it is very sort of author-centric, and not to take away from the actual power of design or the glory of architecture, but in a way, when it comes to built environment, everyone has a stake in it. Everyone, it's part of everyone's life, and there should be processes that enable everyone to have a voice. We're all working together in multidisciplinary teams, and especially the built environment is like really a sum of all these parts and different stakeholders. So the main goal of the policy is to increase cooperation and communication between these different parties that, you know, with different projects and different levels sometimes can be a little bit like working separately and whether even if they are part of the same organization or government. So the good architecture in a way is this more cooperative, more like a co-design way of approaching things, and that really is the ethos of the future architecture here.
For Monocle in Helsinki, I'm Petri Purtsov.
We continue our Nordic tour in Norway, a country that knows a thing or two about how to get from A to B. Here, an impressive network of ferries, railways and small airlines ensure that the whole country is fully connected. Monocle's Marcus Hippie brings us a highlight from the Monocle Book of the Nordics on Norwegian mobility.
Norway has a lot of land to cover, but even the most remote parts of the country are fairly easy to get to, thanks to an impressive network of railways, ferries and regional airlines. And as early adopters of the electric car, which constitutes more than half of all new vehicles purchased in the country today, Norwegians appear eager to embrace fuel alternative technology, with shipbuilders, cruise liners and airlines trailblazing the latest models. Thanks to government incentives and funding, the country is speeding ahead of the green mobility agenda. The airline Widerøe. Founded in 1934 by Viggo Widerøe and four other flying enthusiasts, Widerøe first operated as a seaplane ambulance, air taxi, school bus and aerial photo service. In 2020, the airline served more than 2 million business and leisure travelers, with 40 domestic and international destinations on its roster and a turnover of some 3.5 billion kroner, or 355 million euros. The green hue that the airline is known for became its signature color by default when Widerøe visited Canada to purchase two planes. His dream of a silver aircraft with a red stripe was shattered when he was told that green was the only color available. But the distinctive wings of Widerøe now have a more significant meaning. The company is on a mission to become the green airline. It has invested in a fleet of sustainable jet planes. Its Embraer 190 E2 aircraft give off 17% fewer carbon dioxide emissions than its predecessor and are powered with biofuels. Plus, in 2019, Widerøe teamed up with Rolls-Royce to develop an electric aircraft, which it aims to get into the air by 2026. The cruise liner Hurtigruten. Shipping company Hurtigruten has been navigating the rugged coastline and majestic fjords of Norway since 1893. Originally, the cruise liner transported passengers and goods as quickly as possible to the country's northern reaches. Hurtigruten is Norwegian for the fast route. Today, it's a thriving coastal and polar exploration cruise firm. Hurtigruten's flotilla of custom-built expedition boats reaches more than 200 destinations in 30 countries, and since 2019 includes the world's first hybrid cruise ship, the MS Roald Amundsen. The company was one of the first major travel firms to remove single-use plastics from its ships and launched the sustainable initiative Hurtigruten Foundation in 2015. Also a leader in adventure travel, it organizes tours to the Arctic, Greenland, Iceland, and Antarctica, where it has a permanent research center. The ferry manufacturer Brødrene Aa. Ferries aren't always thought of as the most swift and clean transit option, but shipbuilding company Brødrene Aa is changing perceptions. The world leader in emissions-free ships, it was founded by brothers Olav Aa and Bertel Aa in 1947. Initially the maker of mahogany leisure craft, it gradually transitioned into the ferry-making business. Banishing the black plumes often seen billowing from ships, Brødrene Aa specializes in battery-powered carbon fiber vessels with a fleet of sleek and efficient electric boats. It even boasts the world's fastest electric ferry. Released in 2020, the Rik Electra model has a maximum speed of 23 knots and can transport up to 297 passengers. And with the Norwegian government continuing to push maritime innovation along at a steady clip, Brødrene Aa looks well poised to benefit.
Thank you, Marcus. We head south now for a story from Denmark. Now, we've heard a lot recently about various billionaires and their attempts to get into space, but not so much about what they're going to do once they reach their destination or where they're going to live. A new exhibition at the Danish Architecture Centre in Copenhagen is hoping to enlighten us. A local architecture company is presenting its take on the types of buildings they think that the new generation of space explorers is going to need. And they've already tested it in a rather extreme environment here on Earth, as our Copenhagen correspondent Michael Booth found out.
My name is Sebastian Aristoteles and I'm the co-founder of Sega Space Architects.
Why don't we actually go inside your space house?
We call it a space habitat, a moon habitat.
After you.
Just going past a little portable toilet and into the cup. Actually, as we were coming in, it suddenly dawned on me this is maybe a bit of an unpleasant place for you to come back to, because tell me, how long did you actually spend living in here in Greenland?
We were two people for 61 days living inside of this 4.5 square meter space habitat.
I mean, of course, you could go outside, but it was pretty cold and there were polar bears, right?
Yeah, exactly. So we specifically chose northern Greenland, 1,000 kilometers north of the Arctic Circle, almost as far up you can get in Greenland, for the specific reasons that it's very, very cold. Because it's in human nature to cheat. So if you after 50 days, it would have been easy if you wanted to cheat to go outside. But because it was so cold, we were forced to be inside 95% of the time. So we are standing right here in the living quarter, which is where we spend the majority of our waking hours. And then if we look up, we see two sleeping pods.
Oh, yeah.
So those are the most private parts of the habitat. And in one side I would sleep, and in the other side Carl would sleep. So this was actually designed to work both in gravity and without gravity. So the rooms are stacked on top of each other, because moving vertically on the moon is very easy because you don't weigh that much. So it was actually a bit harder in Greenland because I still weigh 85 kilograms.
Tell me about the genesis of the project. Where did this start?
So we are a small architecture studio. We are about 4 years old. And for the first 2 years, we worked very theoretically doing concepts of what we believe would be a better way of living in outer space. I think to give some context, for about 50 years, people and the entire space industry have worked on making people survive in outer space. But now, when there's such a big industry just thinking about that, our purpose is to figure out how do we thrive in outer space? How do we actually make comfortable living spaces, stimulating healthy living environments for future astronauts?
And is it on Mars or the Moon? Or because they're very different environments.
Yeah, they are. Yeah, so we both work with in orbit, on the Moon, on Mars. But this space habitat, this simulated Moon habitat, is for the Moon. It's for the surface of the Moon, and very specifically, it's designed to stay at the peak of eternal lights on the Moon, which is on the South Pole, which is the destination where humans will set foot in a couple of years. As I was just about to start architecture school, a lot of things were happening in the space industry, and specifically the innovations in travel, in space travel, in rockets. Specifically, or more specifically, SpaceX has been landing rockets and got really good at that, and that created a tiny slice of hope that maybe in my lifetime people would set foot on Mars. And that was enough for me to say, okay, if there's just a tiny chance that people will go on Mars, and I love architecture, maybe I can create the homes for people on Mars and the Moon. There's been, I think, almost 600 people in space, and there's been engineers and doctors and fighter pilots and all these professionally trained astronauts. And I believe that our professional background shapes the solutions that we see. So we can see all the same problems. People have a hard time sleeping in space. People are alone in space. People are understimulated in space. But our professional background makes us think of different solutions.
Tell me about this solution. What's it made out of? How did you come to this conclusion?
So this was a long design process. So first of all, the habitat unfolds. So we are standing right now in the unfolded habitat. When it's compact and when it's packed together, it's 7.5 times smaller. It weighs 1.6 tons. And it's incredibly lightweight because it's made out of aluminum and carbon fiber. There has been made inflatable expanding volumes in space before, but never with rigid panels. So our entire habitat is inspired by origami, the Japanese paper folding technique. And the benefit of rigid panels in the structure is that we can have solar panels on the outside. So we used the sun in Greenland to charge the batteries. So it was a completely off-grid living system, exactly like you would do on the Moon.
Who are you selling to? How do the economics of that work?
Yeah, so that took us a while to figure out, but right now we are selling analog habitats, so simulated habitats like this, for research and education. So for example, right now, it's been a year since we got back from the expedition. Right now, we are developing our next habitat for a client in Switzerland. And that habitat is informed by all the things that we learned from this expedition, by living in it ourselves, and then it's going to be used for research.
Can I ask how much one of these costs?
I cannot put an exact number on it, but it's not cheap. It is a pretty expensive structure.
Do you dream about going to space? Is that your long-term goal? Are you in touch with Elon Musk? You want to be the first architect in space is what I'm asking.
I don't need to be the first architect in space, but I would lie if I said that I did not dream about going to space.
Okay.
We are in touch with SpaceX, though. So we can count our potential clients on one hand. So right now it's the European Space Agency, Blue Origin, SpaceX, and NASA, and the DLR, Deutsche Luft- und Raumfahrt.
Sebastian's giant origami space egg is on exhibition at the Danish Architecture Centre in Copenhagen until September this year. For Monocle, in Copenhagen, I'm Michael Booth.
Well, it's almost time to head off. But before we do, we're in Iceland, where early last year we investigated the eye-catching architectural style that can be seen all around the world's northernmost capital. Here with an exploration into Reykjavik's ironclads, as heard on our sister show Tall Stories, is Monocle's Kimberly Bradley.
When it comes to landscape, Iceland lives up to its cliché of being the land of fire and ice, rugged, volcanic, and arctic. But in Reykjavik, the materials in question are less natural and highly unusual. In the city centre, a lot seems to be clad in corrugated sheet metal. Houses large and small, simple or ornate, municipal buildings, mansions, even churches are covered in wavy iron, then painted in bright colors. The corrugations run vertically, making for some jaunty stripes in the Icelandic capital's eclectic, colorful streetscape. Many of the houses are charmingly small and have sizable south-facing backyards to catch what little sun might shine in the winter. Locals call the houses ironclads, and it's hard to imagine Reykjavik without them. I'm from the American Midwest and had never seen corrugated metal cladding beyond farm sheds, industrial factories, and military Quonset huts, so I had questions. Was this a design decision made or a trend followed at one point in Icelandic architectural history? Is the iron about durability? How long have the houses been clad this way here? A bit of asking around yielded quick answers. The corrugated iron was indeed kind of a trend in the late 19th century until the early 20th, when Icelanders, still under Danish colonial rule but moving toward independence, were quickly transitioning from the traditional turf housing most of them lived in. Turf houses are unheated longhouses sided with thick layers of packed earth and sod, and had to do with Iceland's lack of trees. Blame that last bit on the Vikings. Legend has it that they showed up centuries before and chopped down all the native forests to build ships, and then made the land into sheep pastures. The trees never grew back, or if they did, too slowly to use as construction material. So the ironclads represented modernization and a move past poverty at the time. But they also had to do with early globalization. Around the turn of the past century, some Icelanders had begun building prefab imported housing made of wood. But the island's rugged weather proved a bit too harsh for these homes to last long. The iron that the British had invented in 1828 and that its trading ships brought to Iceland, however, withstood the whipping winds and sheets of rain when galvanized and used as cladding. At first only for rooftops, but then also for exterior walls. Corrugated iron siding even protected buildings from a major fire that raged through Reykjavik in 1915. For decades, Icelanders traded their hardy sheep with the British for the material, and after the fire until the mid-1920s, the capital city even enforced a building code requiring that new builds were sided in the stripy iron. The very center of Reykjavik is still packed with these squat, one- or two-story gabled houses. Some of them are so small they're reminiscent of the current North American tiny house trend. Others sport the Swiss-infused chalet style that appeared throughout Scandinavia at the time. White window frames, kitschy ornament, and all. Iceland began building with hardy concrete in the 1930s and beyond, when Reykjavik began growing and the idea of apartment living began to catch on. And for a long while, the ironclads were seen as backward and uncool. But city preservation protections have been ramped up, and more residents recognize that these houses' charm and color only add to Reykjavik's welcoming, intimate atmosphere. Welcoming and weatherproof, here it's an unbeatable combination.
My thanks there to Kimberly Bradley. Well, before we head off, we thought we'd do a kind of live book review, and I've asked Josh Fenner, who's the editor of Monocle, and a man who knows his Nordic capitals, to come and join us here on the show. And I think it's a wheelbarrow he's used to get this giant book in through the doors. It's a handsome beast, the book.
I was going to say, what were you referring to there? I'll take the compliment. Yeah, I just managed to wrestle a copy of our new book from our production editor, Jackie. Obviously, it's out, available for people to buy from January the 20th. We have some book launches coming up, but they're kind of few and far between in the office. They kind of float past like icebergs in people's hands, don't they? And then they quickly melt and disappear into people's personal collections. It's a very handsome book, and I'm delighted that a region that means so much to Monocle throughout our reporting, that cuts through from our worldview to our love of design, has been rendered so beautifully by the books team.
Well, a little backstory. So, you know, often the paper comes from Finland. One of our early investors was from Stockholm, still is. We've always had deep connections there. Our editor-in-chief had a house in the archipelago. So there's something about the atmosphere of the Nordic nations that was imbued into the pages of Monocle very early on. Now, one of the places that you know quite well is Stockholm. You've done some reporting there, produced some kind of guides as well to the city in the past. What are the things that strike you when you go to a city like Stockholm? What are the things that appeal to you?
Well, I think it's funny, it's true of Stockholm, but it's true of the Nordics more generally, as we kind of like look through the headlines and see a more polarised world. There's also this other world and part of Northern Europe that is extremely good at speaking quietly and respectfully, at espousing social democracy, about thinking carefully about how cities are built, about how what we eat is important, about how the design of our homes is important. You know, as we sit in this studio, we're surrounded by, I presume for its soundproofing qualities as well as its niceness, but Danish wool. And, you know, these are countries that know how to make things at home. So what's special about Stockholm? Almost everything, in my opinion. The food is great. There's a real sense of kind of small to medium scale cities done well, and also a sense that these are places that should be part of a broader debate about how we think about the world that we live in, how we think about making cities, making food, making clothes, making furniture. And they also make for quite a nice place to go for the weekend, so that's never a bad thing either.
And I think what's interesting when you go there as a visitor, not just in the tourist heart, but, you know, the scale of the city, you know, that it's not a massive high-rise city, that, you know, that lots of apartment blocks, but all roughly the same height, built in a kind of modest way. But because of the weather, they've had to learn how to make sure that places are properly insulated and have good windows. And because of the darkness in the winter, they've had to think about lighting and street lighting and domestic lighting. So there's lots of small things that perhaps geography and northernness have forced them to do well.
Yeah, but if you also look at what they've kept and what they've allowed, there's this amazing balance between, you know, Gamlestaden, the old town set, you know, it can't get any bigger because it's on an island, connecting to the rest of it. There's an area where the palace is, that can't get any bigger, it's on an island. And there's also a famous and kind of famously tutted at body that encourages people not to go too far beyond the strictures of the city. It's kind of the Nordic Beauty Council or the Stockholm Beauty Council, which stops you building too big, which stops you going too wide, which stops you breaking that visual continuity that makes it incredible. And it's a respect for that built environment built over time that I think makes Stockholm such an incredible place. But I think the interesting thing is that you couldn't accuse Stockholm or the Nordics of living in the past. There are incredible experiments with timber towers, with wooden architecture. If you go to Södermalm, I guess the kind of Shoreditch equivalent maybe of Stockholm, they're doing amazing things. They're building new railway lines. They're connecting the city better. And there's that room for innovation as well amongst the beautiful old townhouses and the correct proportions. So I think rather than knock everything down and start again, Stockholm, I think, succeeds because it keeps things a little bit the same and keeps a flavour of its illustrious past and everything it does in the future. And I think that could probably teach certain cities rather a lot.
Yeah, and just on that, you're right, it's not stuck in the past. And of course, all these Nordic countries face some of the challenges that any city faces. You know, how do you integrate new communities into the city? They have certainly some neighbourhoods which have some tougher issues going on. But again, when it comes back to the things you're talking about, there's also this invisible thing that helps the urban world and the Nordic world. Quite a lot of safety nets in place, you know, for people when they're unemployed and when they need help. You know, the social democracy shines through. But thank you, Josh. Let's go and have like an open sandwich, I think. That's what's on the cards for us.
Definitely, definitely.
Well, that's all for this edition of The Urbanist. Remember to subscribe to the programme for your weekly dose of urbanism. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts or at monocle.com. And if you head to monocle.com/shop, guess what? You can find the Monocle Book of the Nordics. Today's episode was produced by Carlotta Ribello and David Stevens. And David also edited the show. And to play you out this week, here's one of Sweden's best-known exports, ABBA, with Summer Night City. Thank you for listening, city lovers.